Hey, Truth Teller 2020, how's it going?
Pat, please don't out me to the audience. If anyone doesn't know yet, and I'm shocked that you don't know it, that is my screen name on BostonHerald.com. I got a little angry with Howie Carr the other day because he seemed to think 100,000 deaths was a quote-unquote grim milestone, and I've been locked in quite a battle with the Boston conservative class. Apparently, they are small but mighty, and they are angry. So I've been spending most of my days. I mean, occasionally I'll help a kid. I'll stop to help a middle school kid with something. But most of my day is pretty much just a battle royale with the libertarians of Boston.
I can't believe it. Anyway, folks, welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism, but it's for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term and explore how government, with a slight tweak in priorities, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
That's right. So, Pat, I'm fired up. We have City Councilor Andrea Campbell on today's show.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this, too. I think before we get into that interview, we're going to have to decode or explain some things to people.
Maybe defang.
No, not quite. But explain some things to folks who might not know all the education lingo and especially the Boston Public School stuff. So, Dan, you are a high school choice counselor. So you help middle schoolers pick the best high school possible in a somewhat arcane Byzantine system in Boston with the number of high schools that they could choose from. What is an exam school?
Right. So Boston's exam schools go back almost 400 years. The Boston Latin School was formed as a primary school to feed into Harvard, right? Because Harvard is one of the first universities in the United States. Predates the United States, of course, in the colonies, right? And then Boston Latin Academy was the second because, of course, we didn't want females at that time, not we, but the landed gentry, if you will. They did not want the females in at that time, so they started Boston Latin Academy. And then the John D. O'Brien School of Math and Science was added in the 20th century. So don't get me wrong. Please make no mistake. These are amazing schools, world-class schools. Boston Latin School ranks in the top 50 in the United States every year, if not the top 100. And Andrea Campbell is particularly well-positioned to talk about it because she attended those schools, Boston Latin School. As a woman of color, that is unique because Boston Latin School is approximately 50% white. Only 8% of their population is Black, right? Whereas if you look at the city demographic, the citywide population is 8% white. And I don't have the exact figure, but I'm going to say about a third Black, a third Latino, maybe 20% Asian, right? And then a handful of multiracial and white. So the point is, you're seven times more likely if you were white. You're seven times more likely to go to Boston Latin School, the best school in Boston by the numbers and one of the best in the country, than you are to go to any other public high school.
That's a staggering figure.
It's not by accident. It's not by accident. And Andrea Campbell, as a woman who came up through, she has a very interesting and challenging life story as a woman of color, right? She had to fight for everything she got. And I think she would very much say she got a great education. But again, much less likely to go there as a woman of color. And that, you know, this is 20 years ago, right? She graduated quite a number of years ago. And the situation has only gotten worse in terms of access, right? And so now she's a member of the city council, was the president of the city council. And she's in a position to really ask some questions. And she has an amazing 16-page education plan, which she talks about. And it's also online, and people can find it. But I think it's important to recognize that these schools are amazing, but it's only for, there's about 6,000, a little under 6,000 students in Boston go there out of 57,000. So it's, you know, a great opportunity for 10% of kids. The vast majority, or not the vast majority, but a plurality of which are white students.
Right. Okay. So that's pretty in-depth. Thank you for that explanation. You're also very welcome. It gave us some good background on Andrea Campbell. She's also going to mention, or I think you mentioned, and you both talk about it, possibly Mattapan, and the city of Boston has, you know, different neighborhoods. Those neighborhoods are pretty disparate in terms of the socioeconomic status and the racial breakdown. How would you classify Mattapan as compared to other neighborhoods in Boston?
Right. Mattapan is an overwhelmingly black and low income neighborhood. And unfortunately, as many wonderful people as I've met from Mattapan, there seems to be fewer resources. For example, the red line doesn't extend all the way to Mattapan. You know, there's not a single high school in Mattapan. So students are in the K through eight grades, they can go to school in their neighborhood. But as Andrea mentions, for her own children, her son is not able to get a high quality seat in her own neighborhood, even though she's on the city council, right? But let's say you did get a great seat. By the time you get to high school, not only is there not a high quality seat, there isn't even a seat. There's not a high school in Mattapan, even though it is densely populated, right? Lots of school age children, lots of great families, large Haitian population, you know, a lot of great people and community organizations in Mattapan, but just the city seems to not properly allocate resources to Mattapan. And so, as a resident, as a city councilor, I think she's fighting the good fight. And she talks about that as someone, you know, you and I have worked in Boston for a long time, but we're not from Mattapan. We're two white dudes. So I really look forward to folks getting to hear from City Councilor Andrea Campbell about this.
Right. And there's one last point, and I'll make this point. We as a school, at the school where we teach, Dan, we jumped right into remote learning, remote teaching, and we hit the ground running, and we were working really hard. Our colleagues,
you were running pretty fast, as I recall that.
Yeah, we were putting work up. We were making sure the kids were learning right from get go, and our school did a great job of handing out resources before the school shut down. That's hotspots, that's Chromebooks, but there was some perception based on a comment that Andrea Campbell made from other union members. And I've heard this from more than three of my union brothers and sisters in the BTU, Boston Teachers Union, that they thought Andrea Campbell's comment to the Globe was directed at teachers. And so we gave, I think we're going to give City Councilor Campbell a chance to clear that up. And so I think folks, especially those union brothers and sisters who hopefully will be listening to this episode, will be interested to hear her answer and her explanation.
Exactly.
That she was not, I don't think she was directing her ire at the teachers.
Right. The initial request was for data on how kids were doing, right? Like how many kids are signing in, how many kids have we not heard from, right? Trying to assess the situation. Her request from the Boston Public Schools was not directed towards teachers. It was about data in terms of how students were doing.
Yeah.
And like anything in a city, right, with a lot going on, it was spun and she was asked to make a comment. But her intention as a mom of two and in she went to five Boston public schools and graduated and now lives and sends her kids to city schools. Certainly she's not looking at teachers as a part of the problem, right? She knows very well that we're a part of the solution, and she's working hard every day to make sure that the kids get what they need.
Okay, great. So folks, stick around and listen to this interview.
City Councilor Andrea Campbell, welcome to Trickle Down Socialism.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Me too. I'm actually up in the great state of Vermont, as we affectionately call the 802, and I understand you have some family from up here.
That's right. My in-laws still live in Vermont, and my husband's born and raised in Vermont.
Okay, cool. So, I hope you'll be able to find some respite up here. I know for me, it's the antithesis of Boston. You know, it's like it's relaxed, it's chill. There's no traffic, no honking. You know,
a lot of green space and greenery.
Exactly.
I often say I'm the city girl. He's the country boy, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, cool. So we're going to focus our conversation again today on educational equity in the city of Boston, as well as opportunities for young people, both things that I know that you're passionate about. And though I know some of your story, I think perhaps some of our listeners may not. Can you tell us why you got into this work and why it's so personal for you?
Yeah, so I was born and raised in Boston, and I'm a product of Boston Public Schools. I went to five of them. And my father, actually, as well, who was born and raised in Roxbury, was a product of Boston Public Schools. He actually graduated from Boston Tech in 1951. Mm-hmm. So we were taught to take tremendous pride in being a product of BPS. But my twin brother, and I often talk about him often, his name was Andre, instead of graduating from a BPS high school and going off and reaching his God-given potential, he cycled in and out of the criminal justice system, passing away while in the custody of the Department of Correction, which oversees prisons, at the age of 29. And he had a disease called scleroderma, didn't receive adequate health care, and ultimately passes under some very unfortunate circumstances. And so I got into this work to end disparate life outcomes like that. And there are many things that explain the difference in our lives, me sort of going off to and being a success story. But one of the things I look back on and reflect on is just the quality of education I got that differed from his, and the youth development programs that I participated in that also looked different from what he was available to him. And so I care about these issues, not only because I want my constituents to have good services and good programs, but for me, it's personal because of Andre.
Right. So it sounds like what you're saying is there are, you know, tens of thousands of kids in Boston, and so many of them may potentially go either way, either to success or to lifelong challenges, you know, just by the access that they have to resources and great mentors and things like that.
That's right.
And as you know, Pat, my co-host and I are both teachers. I'm a school counselor within the Boston Public Schools. And I wanted to start by talking about yesterday, there was an editorial in the Boston Globe, which essentially read that one in five Boston Public School children may be virtual dropouts. And so as someone who whose work is to support struggling students, I found that language to be a little too restrictive, and it puts an unnecessary label on kids. But I do think that it's a leading indicator that there's going to be a lot more support needed, particularly in the fall. And so that said, what do you see as the greatest challenges facing the Boston Public Schools in the months and the years ahead?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, you know, it was just such a pleasure the first time I met you, and I'm so grateful to you and Pat and all of the educators in our Boston Public Schools, especially now, right? We all are dealing with some tremendous challenges, and to have to teach in this new reality and virtual world, of course, with things going on at home, we're working from home. Some of us have children, some of us are sick or been sick. So I first want to start from expressing deep appreciation and gratitude. I wouldn't be here if I didn't have the incredible teachers that I had going through BPS, right? I think the biggest challenge right now is how do we support our students and in our families in getting their education remotely, right? And then how do we come back from this crisis? When we get out of it, what does educational delivery look like? And you and I both know that there are going to be many students in a sizable amount that are going to experience some learning loss because of COVID.
Oh, yes.
We worried about that, of course, before COVID. And I think what we all know, too, to be true is that there are more students who are more likely to sort of either fall off track or to lose more because they were already struggling to stay on track. You know, mm-hmm. those are our students with special needs, our English language learners, our lower income students. And now we're seeing students who care for their siblings while their parents work essential jobs, what that looks like, students experiencing homelessness, all of that. And I personally know what much of this is like. And so in asking Boston Public Schools to share data, for example, mm-hmm. It was all about how do we support me as a counselor and my colleagues support the district in meeting the needs of our students, our parents, our teachers, making sure that everyone is supported.
Right.
And by whatever metrics the district deems best, right? And so we were asking for information because, believe it or not, it doesn't come to us automatically. We have to request information to know mm-hmm. what's going on. So we are saying, you know, whatever questions you're asking, whatever information you have that get at, you know, are our students safe and healthy? Are our teachers safe and healthy? Are our students continuing to learn? What does that look like? What right. supports will they need over the summer? Next school year, if they're successful, all of that, any information you could provide would be helpful so that we can be partners in really being intentional around those students that will likely fall off track. And in addition to focusing on gathering information so that we can be supportive and ensuring a quality experience now for all participants, all stakeholders. And looking forward, I'm really pushing the district to budget with an equity lens, right? Mm-hmm. What does it mean to support our off-track students, English language learners, students with special needs with intense investments in tutors, specialists, you name it, right? That human capital support that will, I hope, complement what our teachers are doing mm-hmm. every single day. How do we maybe expand learning time? What does that look like? Social emotional support, mental health support for our students and our right. teachers and educators. So I'm hoping that we can have that conversation now before the summer gets here and before the fall, and that we do it bringing everyone to the table, including council colleagues who are in immediate contact with the families.
Right. And so what I hear you saying is that your request of the Boston Public Schools for more data and perhaps accountability was directed at was trying to get at what are the needs met and unmet of our students. And that was not directed at teachers because we're a small city, small enough that, you know, messages can spread quickly. And I think everyone is a little bit on edge right now, you know, a little angsty. And so at least what I read and being in the teachers union, I heard was like information was being requested of the teachers. And it sounds like that's not what you're saying.
Absolutely not. If anything, it was from the superintendent in the district. And frankly, saying to the district and the superintendent through some budget hearings, if this information doesn't exist, if the platforms, the tools, the technology isn't there, let us know. But they weren't telling us anything at all. And of course, my intention never has been, and it never will be, to make our job, our teachers' jobs more onerous difficult or more challenging.
Right.
If anything, it's always about the district in the system, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what's been a little unfortunate, and why I'm so happy to participate in this, and why I've been so joyful to be on calls with teachers is to say, no, this is not directed at you at all. I know how hard you're working. I've been participating in virtual classroom structures. It's amazing what our teachers are doing to go above and beyond. If anything, this is about the district setting standards and letting us know where we
right.
can support.
Right. And I know to build on that, you have developed a pretty comprehensive education plan entitled Action for Boston Children. And that is, I think, a really helpful framework. And in the report, it's mentioned that roughly 80% of students in downtown Boston, in Charlestown, attend high-quality schools, compared with only 5% in Mattapan, which is, I know, where you live presently.
Right.
What do you think can be done about this disparity, you know, keeping in mind that we have a new superintendent who seems very ambitious, looking to make changes, and we're in year three, I believe, of a 10-year rebuilding plan. You know, what might this look like in, say, 5 years? COVID is in the rearview mirror, right? And, you know, where can we go with this huge disparity in a city like ours?
Right. And you know, I talk about being a proud BPS kid, but I'm also now a mother. You know, I have two young boys.
Right.
Alexander is 2, Aiden is 5 months, and just went through the assignment process to try to get Alexander a pre-K seat. And we were unsuccessful. And what was more emotionally just sad was when we were going through the process, how limited our choices were
right.
compared to other neighborhoods. And I thought about all the parents.
Because of the home-based plan.
That's
you,
right.
You have to stick to your home base. Yeah.
That's right. And I thought about all the other parents and families in Mattapan or Dorchester who don't have the option of a good daycare program like my husband and I have that we can keep Alexander in and try for next year mm-hmm. or other options. We recognize our privilege, but many families do not have that. And we know how critical not just education is, but pre-K is.
Right.
And so the plan really focuses on, you know, 4 key areas. And one is the early foundations for lifelong learning. I call it that pre-K focus, you know, birth to 5 critical years. But another piece is the quality issue, the lack of access to quality seats, our high school central office. But the quality seat piece, I think, is so critical. And it just came up in a budget hearing recently where not just myself, but other counselors were pushing for us to do better in our assignment process now. You know, we are not going to be able to guarantee that parents and families have access to a quality school overnight.
Sure.
It's going to take some time. The superintendent admitted as much. And so in the meantime, the Action for Boston Children plan says, well, how do we expand seats in high performing schools to these neighborhoods that mm-hmm. don't have choice right now, mm-hmm. that don't have good options? And right. look at it more about seats, you know, every family having a high quality seat versus a school, right? And I go into the weeds on that. But also, what does it mean to place more of our special education and English language learner programs in some of the high demand, high quality schools? Right now, we see such a high concentration of these students in schools. And then we ask our teachers and school leaders, to go above and beyond to meet their needs. These students need tremendous supports, and we have to be very intentional there. That may mean more resources, more human capital, a whole array of things. And then I talk about, in addition to expanding quality seats and these special students, is how do we recognize and support schools that are innovative right now, that are collaborating with each other in certain neighborhoods. I spent a lot of time with some schools in the Grove Hall section of my district that were saying, hey, we work together sort of informally, but what if we were to create a pipeline right here in our neighborhood of Grove Hall, a K-0 to 12th grade option mm-hmm. for our students, infuse resources there immediately, wrap around supports, and do it in such a way that we change the narrative of this neighborhood. You know, this part of Dorchester is often seen as a place where you can't get a good quality school. Well, guess what? These teachers and school leaders are dedicated, and they're saying we are doing excellent work here. So what does it mean for the district to recognize that and then to support it as intentionally as possible, as defined by the teachers, school principals, in the residents and the students. And right. so I'm excited for this plan and you know, it was put out months ago and I'm hoping last year, and I'm hoping that we can get some more meaningful attention to it.
Yeah, right. And on the topic of high quality schools, I know you're a graduate of Boston Latin, and so I'm sure you're well aware that the exam schools you know, via the central office is looking for a new vendor for the exam school entrance test. And your report actually mentions how these exam schools do enroll a really high number of students, but they tend to be overwhelmingly white, and they tend to be very, very few of them have learning disabilities or are English language learners. And so how can we, you know, as we move into potentially a new testing system, like, how can we guarantee a more equitable distribution of these seats across the city and along a more diverse racial and economic lines?
Mm. And you said it right, you know, more equitable distribution, because that's what it's about. Everyone having their fair shot, right, at getting into to our schools and also having access to quality, good quality schools at every grade level. I often say, you know, I am a proud Boston Latin School graduate. I often also say that but for Latin school, I probably would not have gone to Princeton University and did well.
Right.
But we know in Boston, it's often the luck of the lottery to get an excellent education. And I think that is beyond sad. Our exam schools, of course, are among the best in the nation. And instead of our students having though numerous pathways for success, there's these narrow ones. And it usually goes through the exam schools. And I'm saying that cannot be the case if we want every student in the city of Boston to be successful in life, to reach their career goals and their God-given potential.
Mm-hmm.
And in this system, it's not only our most vulnerable students that are left behind, but many of our highest achieving students whose schools don't prepare mm-hmm. them for that exam, right? The ISE,
mm-hmm.
who don't have the means for test prep, who don't have adequate info regarding the application process, or who test in but simply don't make it off the waiting list. You know, for me, paints the picture of why this is sort of the luck of the lottery. And so this is not just about making exam schools more accessible and diverse. We need more quality schools at all grade levels in every neighborhood available to all of our students from K-0 to the 12th grade, so that they won't have to, you know, wait on a waiting list, go through a process that they don't understand. And so we right. have a lot more work to do there. And I think right now the current system is not designed to allow for all students to reach their fullest potential.
Right.
And for me, that's a system that fails all of us, not just folks who have children in the system, not just parents, not just teachers. You are a taxpayer in the city of Boston. If you care about children reaching their God-given potential, right? We should all care about this and recognize that this system just isn't working for all of us. And that's a problem.
Right, right. And I think this actually ties back to the conversation we were having earlier about the effect of COVID-19 is that, you know, providing Chromebooks and access and things like that have helped, right? But there are still these barriers, and they may be mental health barriers. They may be the fact that children, older children are taking care of younger brothers and sisters. But I think what you're speaking to also with the school choice is there are these barriers in place in our school system. And in order to find equity, we need to start to take some of those away, remove some of those barriers, because the kids that I work with, and I know the kids that you grew up around, and possibly even your own kids, right? They have, in some ways they have things stacked up against them, and we need to help them, you know, have the best shot possible in our
That's school. Right. And we all have a role to play in that.
That's right. So, you know, we are almost out of time, but I cannot end without talking about the summer, because as you know, in the city, the summer is an exciting time. You know, people are going to be getting out more, perhaps social distancing less. I know that many summer camps have decided that they're not going to be running this summer. And many teens in our city rely upon summer jobs, not just for their own sort of things that they would like to spend money on, but I know many of my students share that income with their families. So as far as you're aware, what is the status of the summer job, like the Success Link program? Is mm-hmm. that happening? Is it funded?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is critical, and not just because of COVID-19. We're still seeing in my district, for example, violence. I mean, it's not quiet.
Right.
We had a 17-year-old homicide. Right. So our young people need summer jobs. It must happen this summer. I know the city hasn't yet announced their plan. I know they're planning for it. But I actually joined in partnership with Councilor Janie and Councilor Mejia on this. We actually have a hearing on June 8th to look at all that we can do to create robust summer job experiences for our young people. What jobs can be done remotely? Through online platforms, how do we make it happen? Some of us as counselors are saying we still want to have interns in our office and do creative things to ensure our young people have jobs. You know, I had a summer job through PIC growing up. and I got it going into an office at Latin school. I had a job through ABCD. Those were extremely valuable to me, not just because of the pride I took in having a job and what that meant, but I also used the resources and needed them. You know, we grew up poor in the city of Boston, and so my income was necessary, like many of our young people. So we're going to push for as much summer jobs and opportunities for this summer as we can. And there are a lot of partners and folks out there that we hope will participate in this hearing to give us suggestions and ideas. We hope that folks will write to the mayor and their city councilors to advocate for more funding for youth jobs, expanding Success Link. And I have to give a shout out to Rashad Cope, who lives in my district, who runs the youth jobs program with the city. He's doing an amazing job, and I know his intentions are there too. So we're hoping to all work in partnership to ensure that there's robust opportunities for our young people this summer. And of course, in the fall as well.
Yeah, and that's so important. If there's a way, this is probably a later conversation, but to extend those, because I know in years past there has been a limited amount of school year jobs. But you better believe that in the same way that, you know, when unemployment insurance runs out, some families will be in trouble. It's kind of the same idea, is that if young people and families get used to this income when the school year hits, you know, they're still going to need that income. So I appreciate you taking the time. It's a holiday, and I hope you get the chance to be outdoors. Is it beautiful there in Boston today?
It's a little colder, but in the last few days, it was actually much, much better. It was really warm. The other day, it was almost 80. So, you know, it's New England, right? One day it's great. The next,
wait,
you never know.
Yeah.
But I was I'm really happy to be a part of this. And thank you and Pat for doing this.
Absolutely. And hopefully you'll come back and join us soon. Maybe this fall, or this is certainly like an ongoing conversation. Boston tends to move slowly, so we have to keep pushing, those of us who are fighting for change. And we admire your work, and we appreciate that you would take the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much. Enjoy the holiday and talk soon enough.
You too. Okay. Bye. Thanks.
This week's episode is brought to you by More Than Words. More Than Words is a nonprofit social enterprise that empowers youth who are in the foster care system, court involved, homeless, or out of school to take charge of their lives by taking charge of a business. We believe that when system involved youth are empowered with authentic and increasing responsibilities in a business setting and are given high expectations and a culture of support, they can and will address personal barriers to success, create concrete action plans, and become contributing members of society who live, love, and own their futures. To learn more or to donate, please visit mtwyouth.org.
Hey, Pat, so what'd you think?
Well, I was relieved as a teacher to hear her explanation and to know that she was kind of taken out of context. She was not gunning for us as teachers. She wasn't trying to make us look bad. And she was looking for accountability from the system. You know, that makes me feel better. And I agree with her. I think there needed to be more information about what was going on and what was the plan going forward during the remote learning time period. I also thought she was really honest. This is a personal fight for her. She was in the school system as a kid, and she made it work for her. But she's also trying to make sure that it works for her kids too. And that impressed me.
Exactly. And I think she would agree that she was a beneficiary of the exam school system. Nothing bad to say about the education she got at Boston Latin School. But remember that that's only 9% of the city's population.
Right.
And so when she's asking for data, and when you and I are thinking as educators about how do we support students in the post COVID-19 world, right? We're talking about the other 91% our English language learners, students who may be more vulnerable because of poverty, students who are experiencing homelessness. For the most part, not in every case, but for the most part, they're not attending the city's exam schools, right? And so she's asking questions, yes, about all Boston students, but really the students who need us the most are the other 91%, the vast majority of students in Boston. And so it's fair to say that the students attending the high-achieving schools have people fighting for them, right? Adults, teachers, parents, et cetera. And I think she feels the cause of sort of everyone else, which is a really important distinction, because I don't know if that's always true of politicians, right? Some have a vested interest in helping those who are most powerful, and I don't get that sense from her.
Right. I'd agree with that. And I think if we take this back to what we try to do all the time on this podcast, which is talk about priorities, for me, what this looks like is a real clear understanding that as a nation or as a state, as a city, however you want to look at it, we can't honestly say that we're prioritizing our kids if we're not throwing enough money at the education system. And so, you know, you look at the nation's budget, largely a huge portion of that budget goes towards military spending.
Right.
And if we took a slice of that and tried to throw it at our education system, and you could spread that around the country, there are failing schools in every state, but there are failing schools in Boston, and it just can't be. We can't do that anymore. That's not okay. It doesn't make sense, right? So if we made sure that there was enough money in our, you know, in the Boston public school coffers and the city of Boston to fund every school in order to make sure that it was no longer failing and had all the resources it needed, teachers, support staff, specialists, social workers, I think we could really make a dent in the achievement gap.
I want to push back on that a little bit. I think you can always benefit from more student support and specialists, and certainly special ed and English language learner support teachers. However, I think a big thing that happens when you have schools like the exam schools, right, is that in the seventh grade and in the ninth grade in particular, the vast majority, again, the 91% of schools are losing their highest achieving students. So what I would do with, even if you want to make it an exam school test, that's great. I think kids still need to take the SAT, right? I mean, they need to practice high stakes testing. They still take the MCAS every year, except for this year, of course. Use the data in the results, right? And reward those kids. Say, hey, you're in the advanced exam school track, but distribute those children across the city. Because what I know, you worked in a big one of the big high schools in Boston. And what happens is when you disinvest, meaning not just money, but when you send a much lower percentage of high achieving students, the culture of achievement goes down in those schools, right? And
yeah,
so
right.
And so we're concentrating all of the highest achieving students, and probably, I don't know this for a fact, but some of the better teachers too in these schools. So you're it's like a vacuum towards these three schools. And it's not necessarily just money. I think if we distribute, we use this opportunity as, you know, every crisis is an opportunity. We have the exam school test has gone away. We don't have one currently in the city. We have a major crisis, the COVID-19 crisis. And we have a lot of people saying, where do we go from here? Let's not go backwards, right? Let's have a system where half of the students are white upper income students, and then we'll just see what happens with the rest of the city's kids, right?
Right.
Let's be smart about this, because Pat, in fairness, we're gonna have less money, not more money, coming out of this crisis.
Oh, that's absolutely true. No, I know that. I think you make a really good point in that part of my role, and I saw this about a month in at that big high school that shall not be named on this podcast, it was to build kids up. They felt like they were losers. They felt like I'm not
they
going anywhere.
They picked the wrong school. They ended up at the wrong school.
Yeah, I ended up. They didn't pick the school, but I ended up at the wrong school. And my job was the cheerleader. You know, I got them to believe in themselves. And it was only through that some of them were able to get enough confidence to reach out for the colleges that they actually, you know, that they wanted.
Didn't you
to go
get
to.
Voted like coolest teacher or something like that?
Most influential teacher, but yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I you've been pretty influential for me, Pat. I mean, I never had a podcast until now.
Yeah, that so that
I
is
feel pretty
true.
Good about that.
What do you have coming up next, Dan?
Well, you know, to be honest, I really want to talk more about education because this is something that's really on my mind. At the same time, I feel like COVID-19 is kind of sucking a lot of the air out of the room. And I really want to know what's going to happen with funding coming from the federal government, because the state and local governments are facing a cliff, like a fiscal cliff. You know, unemployment insurance is running out probably by the end of next month. And states are not going to be able to fund their government for much longer without a major intervention by Congress.
Right. Yeah. So we'll get that in the queue here. I can't promise that's going to be our next podcast, but we appreciate the listening, folks.
Hey, we'll see you next time on Trickle Down Socialism.
That's right. This episode was brought to you by Trickle Down Media, written and created by Dan Goldsberry and me, Pat Donahue. Special thanks to our guest, City Councilor Andrea Campbell. Episode edited and produced also by me, Pat Donahue.